now detonate the reality bomb!
Change has come to America.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know,
catapult to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
The future of our world is apparently about to be profoundly impacted and has already been by a group that wants to turn back the clock to the 7th century. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest tonight is new to this program and someone who's going to share a rather unique area of expertise. He was a former Arabic linguist in the 101st Airborne Division, and we thank him for his service there. He's the author of the book Holiest Wars and a specialist in Islamic eschatology. Our topic tonight, the Islamic State, what do they want? Our guest, Dr. Timothy Furnish. Tim, or is it Tim or Timothy? Which do you prefer?
Tim's fine.
Well, thank you very much for joining us tonight and making time in your schedule. The Islamic State has been all over the news in recent months. How much of what they have done in terms of their political and military objectives has surprised you?
Well, nothing in terms of their stated goals, Derek. What was surprising to me as someone who's been studying Islamic eschatology, Islamic end time beliefs and movements, since about, oh gosh, I guess I was looking up earlier today. My first publication on this was in graduate school in 1997. So I've been on this topic for some time. I started the website in, I think, 2006. What surprised me about ISIS was that we finally had a group in the modern world, not just a group from, you know, the 19th century or earlier, which is when you get a lot of the movements like this in the Islamic world. We finally had a group in the modern world that was openly saying it was fighting and it was trying to do things to bring about the Islamic apocalyptic battle before the end of time. So that's what was striking to me, that they were so stridently, I guess, overt about it. There have been a lot of groups that have sort of hinted at it and made reference to it, but ISIS, by far in the modern world, is sort of the most overt group in terms of Islamic eschatology.
And you mentioned your website, and I'm a bad host for not giving the web address right up front. It's MahdiWatch.org. We keep hearing from media pundits, political pundits, analysts, and we hear from our president just within the last week, that the Islamic State, ISIS, is perverting Islam. How true is that statement?
Well, it's blatantly absurd. The Islamic State, if anything, basically articulates literal beliefs and teachings of the Quran, the Hadiths, the Islamic traditions, allegedly going back to Muhammad, as well as examples from Muhammad's own lifetime in ways that other groups don't. The problem with ISIS is not that it's not Islamic; it's that it's brutally, literally Islamic. So that's the problem. A lot of groups in the modern world that claim to be Islamic simply aren't as there's really no other way to put this. Simply aren't as pious as ISIS. So ISIS basically strips away all of the what they see as Western accretions and other sort of philosophical and other incursions into Islam that shouldn't be there. And that they just go with what they think literally. Not what they think. They just go with literally what the Quran says, what the Islamic traditions say. Now, granted, they do pick and choose among these. I mean, for instance, I've analyzed all of their, they published this magazine called Dabiq, D-A-B-I-Q. Which is the name of the site of a town in northwestern Syria that, according to Islamic tradition, these hadiths that I mentioned, will be the site of a major, if not the major, end time battle between the forces of Islam and the forces, according to the hadith, what are called the Romans. Of course, the hadith, which was written probably if it is a legitimate one, was probably written in the 9th century AD, maybe 8th century AD. The Romans it refers to are the Byzantine Christians, the old Eastern Roman Empire, which was Christian. And they then in this Davik magazine is named after this battle, which they believe will be fought between Muslims and Byzantine Christians, which of course they update to mean us, and they also throw the term crusader about. But in all of these issues of Davik magazine, they make a great deal of, there's a great deal of emphasis on Islamic eschatology, end of time. They pull Quran and Hadith, Quran verses and Hadith citations to support what they're doing. Things like beheading and so on, even the burning alive of the Jordanian pilot and others. They find ways to justify that under different interpretations of Islamic texts. So anyway, it's a long way of answering that, of course, what the president has said is absurd. Now, there are a lot of people that argue that what the president is doing is, I guess Machiavellian politics, right? The president knows, this argument goes, that the president knows full well what the deal is with Islam, that in order not to alienate the world Muslims, in order to sort of get the so-called moderate Muslims on board against the so-called extremist Muslims, he won't use the term Islamic terrorism. But then, of course, one could look at this a couple of ways. One is it working? It doesn't seem, in his 6 years in office, to have made any dent in the number of Islamic terrorist groups and Islamist movements. And secondly, one could also say, with a great deal of reason, that it just makes him and the United States look stupid in the face of this terrorist, all these terrorist movements.
Well, even uneducated people such as myself, I mean, and uneducated regarding what about Islamic eschatology, and in particular what this group believes, can see that the president's statement was untrue on its face. But what really astonishes me are the number of people who responded to an article we've referenced here on this program several times now recently, the Graham Wood piece for The Atlantic, What ISIS Wants, which seemed to me, again, from the perspective of somebody who doesn't know very much about Islam in general and their eschatology in particular, to be a fairly balanced piece.
Yes, Mr. Wood's article is quite good. I went through it the other day. It's quite good. I have a few quibbles with it. But overall, it is the best thing I've seen in mainstream media on this topic, perhaps ever.
But most in contrast, you've got an article that you reference at your blog today at MahdiWatch.com, the piece by Fareed Zakaria at The Washington Post, which takes issue with Graham Wood. And I've seen others in Think Progressive and other places that accuse Mr. Wood of being an Islamophobe or just anti-Islamic, whatever term you want to apply. And again, he seemed to me to be fairly balanced. He spoke about how in talking with these young men who openly discuss their desire to immanentize the eschaton, to bring on the end times by provoking a war with the Romans, the United States, or the defenders of the cross, Wood was they seem to just gloss over that. It seems like any criticism against Islam and the violence of groups like the Islamic State are interpreted as being somehow prejudiced.
Right. I mean, it's just that trope is just getting tiresome. You know what's really interesting, Derek, is when I was in graduate school, I went to did my PhD at Ohio State in Islamic history. I started in the early 90s. I finally finished in 2001. And that's not that long ago. But, you know, I took many courses on general Islamic history, quite a bit on the Ottoman Empire, took classes on the Quran, things like that. There was never any issue when you discuss something like, say, jihad. Jihad was, of course, in all of the in theology classes, in history classes, in Arabic language classes, because I actually took all the classes for a master's degree in Arabic, the Arabic language. There was never any debate about what jihad meant. Jihad, 99.9% of the time, meant conquering non-Muslims, expanding the military frontiers of Islamic political rule. And there was never any issue about this. It's only after 9/11 when it became so politicized that there's been any sort of debate about this. And needless to say, I mean, it was Ohio State. It was an Ivy League school. It wasn't quite as politically correct, I'm sure, as a Harvard or a Princeton would have been. But still, most of my professors, if not all of them, it's safe to say, were quite left of center. But there was never any discussion about this. This was not an issue. It's only after it became a instead of a point about history and or something happening, you know, over there and not involving us, that it became politicized, of course, after 9/11. And now I bring that up to say that, you know, this discussion, as you bring forward here, would not have been, there would not have been any tension at all in discussing this. But Wood says things that are just obviously true, and he's attacked by people. So, I think it's kind of funny. It's kind of like, to me, it's welcome to the club, because this is the sort of thing I've been putting up with for years. And so it's nice to hear. It's nice to see someone in the mainstream media get the treatment. But, you know, again, I kudos to Mr. Wood. And there was also a pretty good piece on CNN by Peter Bergen, dealing with the same topic. Again, I'm glad that it's getting out there. But you know, to circle back around to the main issue here, ISIS is not really exemplary in its Islamic bona fides. It is exemplary, I think, in that it's brutally putting them into practice in ways that have not been done for probably several centuries. Mm. But, you know, beheading, you know, as you may know, I've written one of the few academic articles on the topic of beheading in Islam. And beheading is not something that just was invented recently in Islamic history. It's enjoined by two separate passages of the Quran. If your listeners want to find it, my article is called Beheading in the Name of Islam. It was in the Middle East Quarterly in 2005. And I went through the Quranic verses. I went through the commentators, Al-Zamakhshari and a couple of other major Muslim commentators over the years, that said the beheading passages, they mean exactly what they say. You can behead the unbelievers, particularly when you encounter them on the battlefield. And ISIS is simply doing this very literally. I mean, for that matter, the main way of punishing, the main method of execution in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is what? Derek, you probably know this. Beheading.
Yeah.
And so basically, Saudi Arabia is not really that different from the Islamic State. It just sort of, it juridically, the sociologist would say, routinizes the beheading, but it does the same sort of thing, just on a different scale, with exactly the same legitimation.
Hmm. So what is it that ISIS believes about the end times, and how does that guide them in their political and military objectives?
Yeah, now see, that's sort of a subset of the general, as I was saying, Islamic bona fides that are adduced by ISIS. And remember, it's not just ISIS. I mean, there is really an angstrom unit of difference between what ISIS teaches, what Boko Haram teaches, what Al-Qaeda teaches, what Abu Sayyaf teaches. And you could just go Google the State Department list of foreign transnational terrorist groups, of which two-thirds of which are Muslim ones. And the ideology is basically not any different. It's just that, again, as I said, ISIS is a bit more brutal in putting these into practice. Now, the same sort of thing applies with their eschatological or apocalyptic beliefs. And by the way, Derek, just let me say, I prefer to use the term eschatological, because in my experience, the term apocalyptic for most people sort of conjures up thoughts of mushroom clouds.
Mm, okay.
Whereas, and you know, and probably a lot of your listeners know, but a lot of people don't, that the term apocalypse simply means unveiling. The apocalypse of St. John, the book of Revelation, simply means the things that are revealed to him, right?
Right.
So that's literally what it means. But you know, in the popular imagination, apocalyptic means blowing up the world, basically.
Yeah.
And it's not entirely accurate, because in Islamic thought, the end times, like for instance, what I said earlier, when ISIS wants this battle to take place at Dabiq. The battle is called Al-Malhama Al-Kubra, the great battle, the Armageddon-like battle at the end of time, and it's with Christians, meaning as ISIS sees it with us. This battle will take place. I'm getting too deep into this without explaining sort of the general things first. Let me back it up to say this. ISIS, in its end-time beliefs, is not putting forward anything that is not really sort of common belief in Islam, much like the thing with jihad. There was a big Pew study by the Pew Research Foundation a couple of years ago. I believe it was 2012. I have it linked on my latest blog. And they actually ask questions about a number of different Islamic beliefs, things about Sharia and that sort of thing. But they actually ask two very interesting questions. Do you expect the Mahdi to come in your lifetime? The Mahdi in Islam, M-A-H-D-I, means rightly guided one. The Mahdi is the primary eschatological figure in Islam. Both Sunnis and Shias believe in him. The difference is that for the Sunnis, he hasn't been here yet, although there have been a lot of pretenders to his throne, I guess you could say. For the Shia, particularly the Twelver Shia of Iran and Iraq, he was here a little over a millennium ago. He went into what's called occultation. He disappeared. He did not die, however, and he will return at the end of time as the 12th Imam. Mm. This is who, remember when Ahmadinejad was president of Iran, he talked about him a lot.
Right, sort of in a Islamic version of King Arthur, the once and future king, the once and future Imam.
In a sense, right. Yeah, it's sort of King Arthur and a Messiah, sort of a messianic King Arthur, I guess is the best way to put it. But anyway, Pew asked this question, do you expect the Matthew to come back in your lifetime, in this lifetime? And I crunched the data, and it averaged out to about 42% of Muslims say they expect the Mahdi to come in their lifetime. That's over 600 million people. They also asked, do you expect Jesus to return? And again, folks may not know this. Some do, some don't. In Islamic thought, according to the Quran and according to many of the hadiths, Jesus was not crucified. He was taken to heaven before he died. In Islamic thought, he will come back about the same time as the Mahdi, and he will, of course, reveal he was a Muslim, and he and the Mahdi will basically make the whole entire world Muslim. But anyway, 35% of folks polled by Pew of Muslims said they believe Jesus will come back in their lifetime. So when ISIS, in their first five Davik magazines, talks a great deal about Islamic eschatology and the end time battle, as I was saying, and says and quotes at length a particular hadith that says after this battle, Jesus will show up and kill the Dajjal. The Dajjal in Islamic thought is the Antichrist. He's the major bad figure of Islamic end times, and he will be killed by Jesus. So when ISIS, you know, adduces this long hadith and then explicates it and says one of the reasons they're fighting is because, you know, they have to be prepared and be prepared to be the army of the Mahdi, I guess, as it were, to fight the Westerners, the Christians, in order for, you know, Jesus to come and kill the Dajjal and all of this to sort of roll together. They're not perverting Islamic texts at all. They're simply just reading them literally. Now, what they are doing differently, however, is they're taking steps as they see it to what folks in my field call sometimes hotwire the apocalypse. I think they're trying to do things to cause it to come about. And so I think that is different. I don't know. I'm a Lutheran. I go to church every Sunday and we do either the Apostles' Creed or the Nicene Creed. Mm-hmm. And it says at the end of the creed, you know, that I believe Jesus will come again to judge the living and the dead. I say that every Sunday. Other than trying to live a good Christian life and teach my children to do likewise, I don't go about trying to cause Jesus to come back because, first of all, I'm not that full of myself. I don't know how to personally hotwire the apocalypse other than trying to be a good Christian, right? But there are folks in the Islamic world that think that if you do certain things, you can sort of cause Allah to move up his timetable. And I think ISIS is clearly one of these groups, whereas most Muslims that believe in the Mahdi would say, well, you know, it'll happen at some point, but it'll happen when Allah decides and I can't do anything about it. ISIS is taking active steps to sort of realize, you know, use a fancy word, to reify the eschatological texts and make them real. So I think that's what's really different about them. But in terms of the actual beliefs, they aren't any different from what tens, if not hundreds of millions of Muslims actually believe.
Hmm. Why is it that we in the West, and especially progressives in the media and in our government, seem to have such a difficult time grasping this concept? Am I misreading the situation? Do they really, are they playing a Machiavellian game where they really do get it? They just don't want to let anybody know that they get it, or are they really as clueless as their public statements seem to indicate?
I think that depends on who we're talking about, Derek. I think we have both. John Kerry, I tend toward probably the latter explanation. The president, the director of Central Intelligence, John Brennan, who has a master's degree in Arabic studies and was the station chief in Saudi Arabia, and who, according to some of my friends, you may have seen this, is supposedly a convert to Islam, although I'm not sure I believe that. I think folks like that know full well, and I think they're more sort of the Machiavellian bent. But in general, getting outside the administration, talking about major media organs, the mainstream media, I think by and large, it's just massive ignorance. Why is that? Well, we could probably do a whole show on that, my friend. But my Cliff Notes version would be this. Many in the media are, shall we say, left of center. Would that be accurate to say?
I'd be fair, yes.
Many in the media are left of center. The left, going back to the Enlightenment, going back to Voltaire and all those guys that came up with the wonderful Enlightenment ideas, for them, the enemy was always whom? It was always the church. When they talked about a religious enemy, an oppressive religious structure, it was always the church. You know, it wasn't the Hindu establishment in India, and it certainly wasn't Islam. It was the church. Excuse me. So starting with the beginnings of leftist, if you will, progressive thought, although that always bothers me because that implies the rest of us are regressive, but I know what you mean. Going back to the Enlightenment, the enemy is always the church. You come up through the 19th century, you get Marx added into that. And Marx certainly only ever, I mean, he would talk about religion being the opiate of the masses, but we know what he meant by that. It's clear. He meant Christianity. And then once you get to the 20th century, you get the breakup of the British, and, you know, there were a lot of colonial, well, not a lot, but there were the colonial empires that existed, British, French, to a secondary degree, Spanish, Portuguese, Belgian, Dutch. These colonial empires generally were created in the name of Christianity. So Christianity was, to some extent, an oppressive structure overseas, particularly in Muslim lands. And once you get, you add Enlightenment ideas, anti-church ideas, you had Marxist anti-church ideas, you get from the 20th century, and then you get political correctness, you know, where the source, I mean, some people think that the only colonialism that's ever existed has been, you know, European Christian colonialism. It always cracks me up, these people. They seem not to be aware of the fact that the Ottoman Empire, you know, which was the largest Muslim empire ever and ruled the Middle East for 400 plus years, was often seen as colonialist and imperialist by Arabs, because who didn't like being ruled by Turks, for instance? Needless to say, people like Greeks and Bulgarians, people that were Christian, not Muslim, didn't like the Ottoman Empire's imperialism. So, and of course, China, in many of its incarnations, different Chinese dynasties of imperialists. But anyway, for most people that went to public school in the West, the only colonialism and the only imperialism that ever existed is Western. Just like only slavery was the transatlantic slave trade, right? These people seem totally unaware that there was an Islamic slave trade that in some ways still continues.
Yes.
So I think when you add all of this together, what you get on the left, I mean, capital L left, you know, I mean, hardcore ideologues like the president. I'm not talking about your basic union guy. I'm talking about hardcore left in the media, in the Democratic Party, and in the universities. The enemy is always the church. And Muslims, because they tend to think that Muslims all have brown skin, although they sure must not know about Turkish Muslims and Bosnian Muslims and Albanian Muslims, many of friends, among the ranks of which are many of my friends, they think that Islam, this is part of that tired trope that Islam is a race, right? If you're somehow critical of Islam, you're racist. I'm like, how can you be racist? Islam is a belief, not a skin color. But they equate Islam with oppressed brown people, oppressed by white Christians. And you add all that up together, and basically what you get is you get the New York Times editorial board, and you get folks like that who will never say anything negative about Islam because they're so conditioned only to think that the enemy is the church, and particularly white people in the church.
Yeah, and they're not paying any attention to the way Islam, especially in its most pure forms, as defined by or practiced by the Islamic State, treats women and homosexuals and so forth. You make a point that I think we need to examine a little bit again, because it is one of the things that we in the West don't understand, self included, and that there are factions and divisions within Islam. It is not a monolithic belief, just as Christianity is not a monolithic faith. The Islamic State has been just as violent against other Muslims that don't agree with the way the Islamic State practices its faith as it has been against Jews and Christians and anyone else in the way. What is it that makes the Islamic State different from more, I don't know if moderate is an appropriate term, but what is it that makes them different, and how is that again reflected with the decisions that they've made, the alliances that the Islamic State has made in Syria and Iraq?
Well, they're brutally Sunni Muslim, and you're exactly right. Even more than Christians and Jews, they hate Shia, particularly Twelver Shia. The Twelver Shia, again, mainly Iran and Iraq, also Azerbaijan and Lebanon to a certain extent. And Twelver Shia, there are three different major branches of the Shia. Again, I'm glad you brought that up. A lot of people just say it's Islam, or they may know it's Islam and Shia. Well, the Shia have at least three different branches, the Twelvers, the Seveners, and the Fivers. The Fivers are the Houthis that you may have heard of in, you know, the
Oh, Yemen, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yemen, exactly. The Ismailis are a little more nebulous. They're under this guy called the Aga Khan. And the Ismailis, there's about 20 million of them, are actually, I would argue, one of the perhaps the truest example of moderate Islam, because they are an Islamic group that sort of evolved to the point where they don't think that the Quran has to be read literally. So they are really, you know, we talk about extremists and moderates. It's not ISIS who's the extremist. The extremists are people like the Ismailis who say you don't have to read the Quran literally.
Hmm.
Interestingly enough. But yes, there are dozens, if not hundreds, of different sects in Islam. Maybe not as many as we have in Christianity, but again, you know, Christianity is a bigger religion, 2.2 billion versus 1.6 billion. And ISIS thinks that the only legitimate kind of Islam is their literalist, brutal Sunni kind. They hate the Shia in particular. It's interesting, if you read through those Dabiq magazines again, they don't even refer to them as Shia. They refer to them as two different terms, well, three different terms. Murtadun, which means apostates. Rawafid, which means rejectors of the truth of Sunni Islam. And they call them Safavis or Safavis. And again, this is something from history. Sometimes history comes in valuable. The Safavids were the dynasty that ran Iran from the early 16th century up through the 19th century. That were Twelver Shia, militantly Twelver Shia, who fought the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire was a Sunni empire. So it's interesting that they refer to the Iranian and the Iraqi Shia as Safavids. So they hate them. They think they're, you know, an aberrant, heretical form of Islam. And again, they hate them even worse than Christians and Jews, because you can't expect that much out of Christians and Jews, right? Because mm-hmm. they don't even have the right book. But the Shia have the right book, and then they've screwed it up. So I mean, there have been groups like ISIS in Islamic history before. They tended not to create states. They tended to be sort of the best way to put it, I think, would be sort of insurrectional movements within larger states. I mean, the Ottoman Empire had a movement like this back in the 1600s, and they crushed it. So what's kind of unique about, again, ISIS is that they have managed to set up a state, and a state not on the margins, like Al-Qaeda, not off in some, because look, you know, no offense to Pakistani and Afghani Muslims, but that's pretty much the margins of the Islamic world. Syria and Iraq, particularly Syria, is in many ways the central Islamic lands. It's the central, it was always considered to be sort of the most civilized areas. The Abbasid Caliphate, which was considered to be the golden age of Islamic history, was headquartered at Baghdad. The other major Islamic empire before them, the Umayyads, was headquartered in Damascus. So you sort of have this Damascus-Baghdad axis was sort of the civilizational center of Islam. I mean, you did have Mecca and Medina, of course, were very important. But Mecca and Medina were never large cities and were never after the first couple of years of the emergence of Islam, were never the capitals of the empire. It was always Damascus and Baghdad and then later Istanbul. So ISIS has grabbed territory in the center of the Sunni Arab world and is enforcing this very literalist Islamic view, again, as we talked about, with eschatological overtones. So that's, in some ways, that's rather unique in Islamic history.
Hmm. The Ottoman Empire at its peak in the, the 16th century was sort of the
peak? Yes, that would be the peak, probably 16th, early 17th.
Okay. And it's the area that it covered was huge. I think we in the West kind of forget how big the Ottoman Empire was. I mean, they were at the gates of Vienna at one point. They had overrun all of what is today Spain. They were in France. It took Charles Martel to drive them back.
Well, Derek, excuse me, that wasn't the Ottomans. The Ottomans didn't come along until the 1300s.
Oh, okay. All right.
There were empires from North Africa, Islamic empires, up into the Iberian Peninsula and then into France, as you correctly point out, defeated by Charles Martel in 732 at the Battle of Tours or Poitiers, depending on which town you want to go with. That was an Islamic empire, but that was not the Ottoman Empire.
Okay.
Ottomans came around in the 1300s.
And the Ottomans didn't really fade from the scene until Ataturk after World War One. What are the differences between the caliphate as the Islamic State hopes to create it and the caliphate of the Ottomans?
That's a very, very good question. I'm glad you said that. So I have a great deal of sort of a, I even have to, I was going to say respect for, even in some ways, admiration for the Ottomans, because, I mean, it was, as you point out, an enormous empire. I don't know the square mileage off the top of my head, but it was on three continents. Headquarters in Istanbul, the old Constantinople, which they had taken from the Byzantine Christians in 1453. They ruled at their height most of southeastern Europe, the Middle East, and most of North Africa, and a lot of the Arabian Peninsula. So a very large empire. Excuse me, the biggest difference between their caliphate and the ISIS caliphate, besides obvious size, well, I'd say there's two big differences. One is legitimacy. There is almost no Muslim alive today that does not look back and say that the Ottoman Empire was a legitimate caliphate. Hmm. The Ottoman Empire was, I mean, even bin Laden said this. I mean, bin Laden talked about dissolution of the Ottoman caliphate being a horrible time in Islamic history. And a lot of the groups today that want to bring back the caliphate, like Hizb ut-Tahrir, will say that, which I always think is interesting because most of the folks that seem to want to bring back the caliphate are Arabs, but the Ottomans were Turks. Anyway, I also like to sometimes, poke fun at my Arab friends when I'll say, when the Ottoman Turks were in charge, you guys behaved yourselves. They don't like that much, but it's historically true. Yeah. But the biggest difference, I think, between the Ottomans and ISIS is this. The Ottomans ruled a large empire that 20 to 25% of that empire was non-Muslim. They had very large Christian minorities. They had some Jewish minorities too, but the largest minorities were the Christians, the Greeks, the Bulgarians, the Georgians, the Armenians. And we know that things really went south in 1915 with the Armenians. But for most of the empire's existence, unless you had some really crazy or, alcoholic, stupid sultans, the Ottoman government knew that a lot of the important things that went on in the empire were done by Christians. Christians could have just about any position in the empire except for Sultan. So I'm not going to pretend it was some sort of like very tolerant empire. Christians were accorded, like Jews, accorded the historical status of dhimmi, which is a second class citizenship. There were certain things you were prohibited from doing. And you were never allowed all the full rights that a Muslim had. But still in large, for most of the empire's existence, they had to take into account the fact that they had large Christian minorities. ISIS doesn't give, forgive me, but this is literally true, ISIS doesn't give a damn about this. ISIS thinks the best things to do with Christians is run them out. You know, if they won't get out, ISIS does seem to be violating Islamic law in some ways, because you aren't supposed to do injury to Christians and Jews under this dhimmi status. You're supposed to treat them as, you know, sort of protected second class citizens.
People of the book.
Exactly.
Okay.
People of the book. Right. Because under Sharia, Christians and Jews have the Bible, which is not as good as the Quran, but it is a revelation from God, unlike, you know, the Hindus or the Buddhists or anyone else. So the biggest thing there, I think, is that ISIS, again, much smaller population, but ISIS is basically persecuting its minorities in ways that the Ottoman Empire never would have done.
I've got a friend who is a professor at the University of Illinois Springfield, who spent a great deal of time in Turkey in recent years teaching English, and is back home now as an American looking in on the Turkish political situation. He had some insight there that we looking in from the West do not have, and he is of the opinion that that Erdogan in Turkey is playing a game and perhaps even using ISIS as a stalking horse to advance his own agenda in the Middle East. There has been some indications that there is a pan-Turkic movement that has been at work behind the scenes, and Turkish peoples, people of Turkmen descent, stretch from modern-day Turkey all the way to Western China. The Uyghurs of Xinjiang province,
right? China.
Yeah, and of course Turkmenistan, which is named for the Turks. Looking at this from the perspective of a military analyst, do you see any evidence that that might be the case, that the Turks are sort of allowing ISIS to do what it does for Turkish purposes?
Well, I know there are people in Turkey that think like that. If you want to see a good map of that, Google the guy called Harun Yahya. He's also called Adnan Oktar. I don't know if you ever heard of this guy. I interviewed him in Turkey a few years ago. Adnan Oktar, I think, thinks that he is the Mahdi, and he has sort of a cult following in Turkey, and he is very much a proponent. Interesting chap. He's a proponent of Mahdism, belief in the Mahdi. Although, to be fair, the ideas he puts forward about the Mahdi are very peaceful ones. He's not a warlord. He's more sort of a guy that persuades everyone to join with him. He also is very strongly opposed to Darwinism. So he's in some ways, I guess you could say, an Islamic creationist. But he's also a very strong proponent of what some folks call Neo-Ottomanism. And if you look at his... You can Google and see he's got a map up of the, I forget how he calls it. I don't know if he calls it I think he calls it the Turkish Islamic Union, which is along the lines of what you're talking about, where everyone that speaks even some mutually unintelligible version of Turkish would fall under this, as well as all Muslims. Mm-hmm. So he's got an interesting map to this effect. That has been ascribed to, and I think with some good reason, to Davutoglu, who is sort of the strategist for the AK party, which is Erdogan's the head of. It was also said to be the theory of Fethullah Gulen. You've heard of Gulen, I'm sure.
Yes, uh-huh.
Gulen is the Islamic thinker who lives in Pennsylvania, because he got kicked out of Turkey in 1991, back when Turkey was much more secular, and he was deemed too religious. He and the founders of the AK party in Turkey, including Erdogan, I guess, got along at one point. Now they don't get along at all. But Gulen also was one of these that seems to have been a proponent of this sort of neo-Ottomanism, this sort of pan-Turkic union. So that end of it, I think clearly there are people in Turkey that think along those lines. Now, how does ISIS figure into that? You know, honestly, Derek, I'm not sure. I sometimes get headaches trying to figure out exactly the logic of Erdogan's position. Yes, there are those that have advanced, and I'd say that's probably a plausible theory, advanced the theory that he is using, would you say, a stalking horse? Yes, I think that's a very good phrase for what some people have said he might be doing. You know, on the other hand, if you look at it really from sort of a, I think more sort of a military and political objective analysis, one could certainly think that, what are you thinking in Turkey? Because ISIS is just as injurious to your strategic plans in the region and as it is to other people's. I mean, I think probably you could probably make this too complex. What it may just boil down to is, you know, for years and years, for about 40 years, the Turks have been fighting a separatist Turkish movement, right? The PKK and other Turkish groups, the Kurds make up about, excuse me, not Turkish, Kurdish groups. The PKK make, hang on.
Sure.
Coffee, Sunday night. The Kurds make up about 25% of the population of Turkey. Kurds, for the folks that don't know, Kurds are Muslim. Most of them are Sunni Muslims. They, however, are a different ethno-linguistic group from the Turks or the Iranians or the Arabs. Kurdish is a different language. In fact, some people think that the Kurds are the largest, that probably is true, the largest stateless people in the world. They're the largest group of people, about 30 million of them, don't have their own state. So for many years, they have been fighting, some of them against Turkey, some of them against Syria, some of them against Iraq, some of them against Iran. I mean, they're sort of a pain in the neck to everyone there that has an existing state. But they've been the biggest pain in the neck, arguably, to the Turks. And, you know, they're now embroiled, the Kurds are, with fighting ISIS, because the ISIS particularly hates the Kurds. Again, although they're fellow Muslims, they don't like them in particular because for two reasons. One is a lot of the Kurdish groups are secular. The PKK actually is Marxist in ideology. And another thing is that the Kurds that aren't secular or Marxist are seen by the by ISIS as heretics because many of them belong to these mystical Sufi orders. And plus, the Kurds are not afraid of them, unlike some folks. The Kurds don't turn tail and run like the Iraqi army. They've been fighting them. But, you know, I think one could try to simplify it, which I'm not doing a very good job of, and say that biggest reason Erdogan probably doesn't like, probably is willing to turn a blind eye, I should say, to what ISIS does, or at least not help in the fight against ISIS, is because ISIS is fighting his enemies, the Kurds.
Hmm. Enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Yeah, I mean, you know, let's apply Occam's razor here. It probably works.
Back in December, and this is an article that got me thinking along these lines, and I'm glad I finally stumbled across your work. As you mentioned, you've been writing about this for quite some time. Back in December, there was an article about the United States and our efforts to try to understand what ISIS is all about. Targeting its psychology was the New York Times article. Major General Michael Nagata, who's the commander of Special Operations Forces in the Middle East, has said, and I quote, "We do not understand the movement, and until we do, we are not going to defeat it. We have not defeated the idea. We do not even understand the idea." What would you recommend to the American government or the American military or both as a means, as a way to understand and then defeat the idea behind ISIS?
Well, I could read my website. That would probably be helpful. they also could just go read Dabiq themselves, which is in English. Yes, I remember. Yes, I blogged on that. Major General Nagata, who I'm sure is a very smart man. And again, I have friends, some of whom are retired from various agencies and some of whom were fairly high-ranking officers, who say, you know, General Nagata fully understands the deal, but in this administration, he's not allowed to say that. Which, if that's true, that's a pretty damning indictment, unfortunately. Let's just take it on face value. He doesn't understand it. That's really rather sad that here we are 13 years after 9/11, when 67% of the groups on the transnational terrorist list from the State Department are Islamic groups. These Islamic groups, not just ISIS, but Al-Qaeda and Jabhat al-Nusra and Boko Haram, tell us on an almost daily basis what they're doing and why they're doing it, but yet we purport to not understand it. I mean, that makes, I don't know about you, Derek, that makes me sort of fear for the future of Western civilization.
Well, Right. When we see that they clearly don't understand it because they don't want to understand it because they've got blinders on. And I think that was Bernard Haykel's comment or quote in the piece by Graham Wood. They don't understand it because they don't want to understand it. When you're right, when they're telling us flat out, this is what we're doing and this is why we're doing it, instead of saying, well, they don't really mean that because they're perverting Islam. And instead, they're bringing in focus group, or rather, they're bringing in business professors from universities to try to examine the Islamic State's branding strategy. Right. Instead of just reading the magazine.
I know your brand, their branding strategy. It's called chopping people's heads off and burning them alive. I mean, you know, I had a drill sergeant back when I was in the Army enlisted many years ago. His catchphrase was, it don't take a GED. It doesn't, you know, I tell people it doesn't take a GED. It sure doesn't take a PhD to figure this out. But, you know, your bigger, more important question there, I think, is what do we do about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we have to use, you know, in the parlance of the IR folks, we have to use hard power and soft power. I agree with that. Okay. Unlike some people, I'm not overly critical of the president using drone attacks against these chaps. I think the only criticism in that regard you could use is that perhaps it would be better off if you captured some of them alive and interrogated them. Rather than just send them all to meet the Houthis as often as we can.
Hmm.
So you have to have hard power. Airstrikes are not enough. I mean, ISIS is not going to be defeated until we drop about 3 Ranger battalions in there, which I'm pretty sure is not going to happen in this administration. But ISIS will not be defeated until there's ground troops. You can't defeat groups like this without hard power. It's clear. But that's not enough. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying it. And I'm kind of an amateur. I wouldn't say student, but at least fan of history. And in reading about the War of 1812, the Indian chief Tecumseh was rallying together a group of tribes, and he was having some success and convincing southern tribes, and these tribes were as distrustful of one another often as they were of the white settlers who kept coming across the Appalachian Mountains. Their goal in the war was to push the whites back across the mountains at least. And he was, again, Tecumseh, having some success in getting building a powerful coalition, getting the Creeks and the Cherokee to agree to consider his proposal. And while he seemed to have this air of invincibility, he was beginning to draw these groups together in what might have been a powerful enough coalition to actually push the settlers out of Kentucky and Ohio and Indiana and back all the way across into the eastern seaboard, until his brother, the Prophet, provoked a battle he wasn't ready for at Tippecanoe, where the militia under William Henry Harrison defeated his forces, which sort of destroyed this air of invincibility that Tecumseh had been building. And the southern tribes then said, well, we'll just hang back and wait and see what happens. And, of course, we've seen what's happened over the last 200 years. The natives are living on reservations, and the whites have spread from coast to coast. Is it possible that, as you say, dropping a few Ranger battalions onto ISIS would inflict enough damage to its reputation that joining this group wouldn't seem so appealing to fighters coming in from as far away as Australia and the United Kingdom and the United States?
Yes, I think it's very possible. And even beyond that, again, remember, ISIS thinks that ISIS is trying to goad us. I am convinced trying to goad us into putting in ground troops because they think it's going to be this apocalyptic battle of that Dabiq town and they're going to win it. And if we put in, you know, the Rangers or whatever other units we want to use, the 82nd, whomever, and beat them, which we would, this would not only make them, as you're getting at, not the strong horse anymore. This would destroy their apocalyptic narrative because they would then lose. Mm-hmm. So I think that it would be doubly a defeat for them. But as I was getting at earlier, the beliefs that drive ISIS are extant in many other groups. In fact, they're extant in Salafi Islam in general, right? That's the bigger problem. Okay, it's sort of like whack-a-mole. We could beat ISIS, but another group's going to pop up like that.
Yeah.
So the bigger sort of long-term civilizational issue, which may be an issue of decades, if not a century or two, unfortunately, is how do you get, I'm not going to say defeat extremist Islam, because it's not extremist Islam. I cannot stress that enough. It's mainstream literal Islam. Jihad is not an aberration of Islam. It's mainstream. All right. People think that it's an aberration because, you know, most journalists can only look back about 10 or 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look back across 1,435 years of Islamic history, jihad is the norm. Non-jihad is the atypical thing. As I was saying earlier, the extremists aren't ISIS. The extremists are some of the smaller sects of Islam that say we don't have to read the Quran literally. And I think the only thing, you know, you'll see and read, and you've seen these, I'm sure, heard people say this, well, they need a reformation in Islam. Well, okay, that's not exactly true, because Luther's and Calvin's reformation really didn't have anything to do with making Christianity more moderate, per se. It had to do with what was the source of authority in the church and how does one achieve salvation, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean,
yeah, Luther said it's not by keeping all the rules of the church and paying indulgences. It's by trusting in the death and resurrection of Christ and the grace that God gives you through that. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's what saves you. But Luther or Calvin or Zwingli or any other reformers weren't particularly about trying to create a more moderate Christianity. So I'm not sure if reformation is the right word. Maybe it's enlightenment. Maybe it's, I don't know, something else. But what Islam needs is they need it to become acceptable that you can read the Quran and you can read these hadiths, again, these Islamic traditions, non-literally. In mainstream Sunni Islam, it's really not acceptable to do so.
Hmm.
So only in some of these sects, as I said, the Ismailis, the second largest branch of Shia, the Ahmadis, who are a group that started in the 19th century, who believe that their founder, a guy named Ghulam Ahmed Shah, was both the Mahdi and Jesus rolled into one. Now, as strange as that may sound to us, and it is strange, they are another group that says that jihad, for instance, doesn't have to be violent, things like that. So there are some other sects. I mentioned earlier the Sufis, who are the mystics of Islam, and the Sufis, not all of them, but many of the Sufi orders have these same sort of beliefs, and which boil down to, you can interpret Islam, or excuse me, you can read the Quran other than literally, right? Hmm. And what Islam really needs is for that to become mainstream. I mean, I saw earlier tonight, somebody had put on Twitter that the head of Al-Azhar in Cairo, Al-Azhar is a mosque and university in Cairo. In fact, it's the oldest continuously operating university in the world. It was created in, I believe, 970 AD, older than Oxford and Cambridge. But the mosque complex there and the head of it, usually called the rector, and it's a guy named Al-Tayyib at this point in time. But that whoever's in charge of this place in Cairo is generally sort of the titular head of Sunni Islam. He said that it is time, and I'm sure he's being goaded by President al-Sisi of Egypt, who, remember, back on January 1st, gave that talk. It was at the UN, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And he said that, you know, we need to, there's something wrong in Islam when so many people are afraid of us and so many people in our religion are violent. So the head of al-Azhar said just recently that, you know, Islam needs to clean up their house and they need to, let me see how he put this. We need to get rid of these misinterpretations of the Quran. Yeah, well, see, the problem with that is, again, I've read the Quran in English and in Arabic. These aren't misinterpretations of the Quran. These are simply literal interpretations of the Quran. So he can't even be honest. It's at some point, Muslims have to be able to be honest. And this is why I have a really big problem with the president's Machiavellian strategy, if that's what it is, where we don't use the adjective Islamic in front of terrorism because we might alienate Muslims. My issue would be that's like, you know, a friend that's like sick and you tell him not to go to the doctor because it may spook him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Are you doing him any favors? No. Say, get thee to a doctor. Islam, I would say, and there's probably polite ways to say this. I mean, it's going to make people mad, but you know what? I'd rather have somebody mad be mad versus beheading and burning people alive. Okay, I'll take the mad if they keep it at that.
Yeah.
You know, Islam, you guys have a problem. You know, the president of Egypt could do it and say, you know, there's one civilization in the world that doesn't work and play well with others. It's not the Hindus. It's not the Confucians. It's not even really the communists anymore. It happens to be the Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
So you guys got to get your house in order. Okay? You've got a problem. You've got an internal problem. You know, a nominally Unitarian president or an Episcopalian attorney general cannot tell people, particularly Muslims, what is and is not Islam. They just can't.
Yeah.
Is ISIS legitimately Islam? Yes. Are there other brands of Islam that are just as legitimate that aren't violent? Yes. But you can't say one's Islam and one's not. It's an in-house battle. And, you know, I wish we could say, you guys take it outside and settle it. But unfortunately, it affects too many of people that are non-Muslims to be able to do that. But that's the long-term solution, Derek. And again, it may be decades or centuries before Muslims are able to get to the point where, you know, they aren't persecuting these Ismailis or these Ahmadis or these Sufis for saying you don't have to read the Quran literally. Because right now, mostly they just get branded heretics. The Ahmadis are persecuted horribly in Pakistan, for instance. There's a big argument about whether they should even be allowed to live. I mean, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine? You know, I mean, we may have had this, you know, 400 or 500 years ago, but the Christian world went through these big fights, and they finally had this thing called the 30 Years' War, you know, which was primarily a religious war.
Mm-hmm.
Between Catholics and Protestants. Of course, the only time they ever got together was when they ganged up on the poor Anabaptists. you know, but we went through that. And the end of the 30 Years' War, the Peace of Westphalia, and afterwards was basically the Christian states of Europe said, we got to stop killing each other in the name of our different brands of Christianity. Let's find some other reason to kill ourselves. Oh, nationalism, that'll work. But we're not going to do it in the name of religion because it's just too easy. All right. Islam has not got to that point yet, and Islam has got to get to that point, and I don't see it anytime soon.
Mm. And sadly, for the rest of us in the world, it only takes one side to pick a fight and start a war, whether we want to call it that or not, and we may be looking at something as ugly as and as archaic in terminology as a holy war before this thing is actually settled. Dr. Timothy Furnish is a specialist in Islamic eschatology, his area of expertise. He's the author of the book Holiest Wars, and he blogs at the website MahdiWatch.org, to which I will put a link in the show notes at vftb.net. I appreciate your time and sharing with it. Unfortunately, there's no real easy, happy solution to this.
There's not. I mean, we have to persevere politically, and you know, also, I mean, my analysis tends to be political and military. I am a Christian. I believe in the second coming of Christ. I believe in that. But I don't generally do my analysis that way, mainly because of the clients I tend to work with. But, you know, let me say that as a Christian, one big thing we need to do is pray. You know, today in church, my pastor prayed for the guy. He prayed for the 21 Coptic Christians that were martyred.
Mm-hmm.
But he also prayed for the guys in ISIS that they would come around and recognize the reality and come to the truth of Jesus and not the false Jesus that they believe in. And so I think one big thing we really need to do is to do that.
Yeah. And when facing this kind of barbarism, people being burned alive in cages, it's easy to forget that our most powerful weapon, according to the Lord, is prayer.
Yes.
Tim, pleasure talking with you, and I hope I can call on you again.
Sure. Thanks, Derek.
Again, those links to the websites I referred to, MahdiWatch.org, and a couple of articles that are key. The article at The Atlantic by Graham Wood. Also, Dr. Furnish's article from 2005 at the History News Network's website titled, What's Worse Than Violent Jihadists?, which is really what prompted me to get in touch with him. Clearly, 10 years ago, he and even further back, he saw that this was coming, and the article from 2005, a good primer on Mahdism the belief that a Mahdi will come and lead the forces of jihad, of Islam, to a victory over the defenders of the cross, was published at the History News Network back in 2005. And I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. Also, the Fareed Zakaria's article today, The Limits of the Islamic Label. You know, we in the West have blinded ourselves to what is coming, what is already here, truthfully, by refusing to acknowledge that what is being done in the name of Islam is not a perversion of that faith, but is in fact a more pure, a more fundamentalist belief, a more fundamentalist strain of the faith. And as I mentioned during the interview, it's ironic that progressives here in the West are more critical of fundamentalist Christians who, if we go back to the Bible and look at what the Bible says, teaches us not only to turn the other cheek, but to love our enemies. Whereas fundamentalist Islam, apparently, when you go back to its core teachings and core doctrines and live them according to the way they were taught back in the day, results in beheadings, people being burned alive, and perhaps next radical amputation of hands and feet. Disturbing, and there does not appear to be any easy answer on the horizon. Certainly a jobs program is not the solution. Coming up on A View from the Bunker, we are going to talk with Aaron Judkins. Actually, we did talk with him, but of course you'll hear that interview coming up this Sunday. His role in a forthcoming documentary, interesting discussion. The documentary called Finding Noah, it will be released, that's the plan anyway, at some point in 2015. It talks about chronicles their 2013 expedition to Greater Ararat, the 17,000-foot mountain in eastern Turkey, upon which it is believed the Ark of Noah came to rest. So you'll hear that discussion this coming Sunday, March 1st. Beyond that, the schedule is kind of up in the air as we've been preparing for our move to Crane. This, as I record this on the evening of February 22nd, this is the week that it happens. We are spending our last weekend in Illinois for the foreseeable future. And as one who was born and raised in the state and spent the last 4 years in the state, a mixture of excitement at the new challenges that lie in front of us, the opportunity to devote full time to a media ministry and continuing to discuss topics that I think are important as a man and as a Christian, and not in that order. That is exciting, but of course we leave some very dear friends that we have made here over the past 4 years. Our church family at First Baptist Church of Charleston, Illinois, the men with whom I've been proud to sing for the last 4 years, the Coles County Barbershop Chorus, and especially the men in the two quartets that I've been singing with, my barbershop quartet, Ring Time, Jeff, Tim, Mike, Brothers in Harmony Forever, and the quartet that we never actually gave an official name, but kind of became known unofficially as the First Baptist Four, Tom, Jamie, Larry. You know what those Wednesday afternoon rehearsals have meant to me over the last few years. So a new chapter begins. And until next time, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.